for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman once called fellow Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz, quote, an insanely great economist. Now in a new book, the author of Globalization and Its Discontents explains why the U.S. is now in a position to fix the mistakes that led to the Great Recession and move toward a more equitable society. The new book is titled Free Fall, and Joseph Stiglitz joins me in the studio. We'll be taking your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Professor Stiglitz, it's good to see you.
Nice to be back here again.
I must say the title of your book, Free Fall, makes me want to ask you immediately whether you think this free fall is over.
Well, we are out of the sense of free fall that we had last fall when no one had a strong sense of when it would end. But we're not back to a strong economy. Growth has resumed, not necessarily robust growth, but unemployment remains at a very high level. The official unemployment rate is 10%. But more telling than that is the fact that almost one out of five Americans who want a full-time job cannot get one now. And that's a startling statistic. Of these, four out of 10 of the people who are unemployed have been unemployed for more than a half a year. The reason that's so important is if you're unemployed for a few weeks, you have your savings to draw upon. But once you start getting unemployed for half a year or more, you deplete your savings accounts, you start losing your work skills, you become discouraged. Prospects of lifetime income, you know, the future jobs they're going to get, go way down. So it's a life tragedy for a very large number of people.
And how long do you think it might take to get that so-called 10% unemployment rate down to, say, 5%? Or will we see 5% again in my lifetime?
Oh, I think we will, but I don't think we're going to be talking about that before 2012 or 13 at the earliest. The basic fact, some discussion about, employment always lags growth. The fact is the growth is not robust enough. If you don't grow fast enough, you don't create enough jobs for the new entrants in the labor force. And our labor force grows about at 1% a year. Productivity grows about 2%. And that means if you're not growing at 3%, you're not growing fast enough.
And yet what Americans all over the country are seeing is the robust growth in these banks, these huge I can't even find the word for it. These huge bonuses that are being given out at the expense of the people you're talking about who cannot find work.
Exactly. And I think what's also feeding the anger is they exist, these big banks, because they were saved by the U.S. government. We gave them that money in order to have them lend. But they're contracting their lending, especially small and medium-sized enterprises, which are the basis of the U.S. economic job creation, are finding it very difficult to get credit. The fundamental problem is that the banks are making profits because they can have access to low interest rates. But when they lend, they charge high interest rates, and that spread between the rate at which they borrow that you would get as a depositor and the rate that they charge is what gives them so much money, so much profits. You know, credit card fees, the credit card interest rates are up to 30% almost, and yet they can borrow at the Fed at almost zero. Not anybody can make money if you can borrow at zero and lend at 30%.
How can they continue to justify this lack of lending without somehow being penalized by the federal government?
I think it's time for the government to take action, to impose regulations, try to change the incentive structures to encourage them to lend. What has gone on is, I think, you know, quite frankly, unconscionable.
Unconscionable is the word for it. Joseph Stiglitz, he's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He teaches at Columbia University. His new book is titled Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. We do invite your calls, your questions, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or reach us through Facebook. Take us back to the beginning. How did we get here?
Well, there are many factors that contributed, and one of the points I try to raise in my book, Free Fall, is to try to parse out blame. Also, I call it peeling back the onion, that you can, for instance, one of the key factors was the banks had bad incentives. The bankers had bad incentives. Their incentive, the bonus schemes, encouraged short-sighted behavior and excessive risk-taking, and they behaved exactly the way the incentive schemes would have expected them to do. But then they asked the question, why do the banks have such bad incentive schemes? Isn't capitalism supposed to ensure that you have incentive schemes that lead to the right behavior?
Balance.
Well, one of the points was a problem of corporate governance. You know, what's so interesting is that the incentive schemes served the bankers well, but they didn't serve the shareholders and the bondholders. They're among the people who have lost a lot of money. One of the problems on incentives is that the banks grew too big to fail. And that was related, in turn, to the repeal of the Glass-Steagall. That's when the banks really started to grow. Now, when you're too big to fail, again, there's an incentive problem. When you gamble and you win, you walk off with the proceeds, big bonuses. If you gamble and lose, the taxpayer picks up the tab.
But Professor Stiglitz, what about the responsibility of the boards of directors in these big banks, in these large institutions? Were they simply sitting there nodding? Were they simply enjoying what they were paid to sit there without doing due diligence and oversight?
There clearly was really serious problems of corporate governance. But one of the points that a number of people, including Paul Volcker, have made is that these banks that are too big to fail are also almost too big to be managed. So those who are sitting on the boards have no way really of understanding what was going on. Moreover, the risks that they were undertaking were so complex and employed complex mathematical models that were really beyond the capacity of many of those lawyers and people without that kind of mathematical training to really fully understand.
And just to go back for a moment, what Glass-Steagall actually did was remove that boundary between banks and financial operations, other types of financial operations.
That's right. I mean, it used to be that we had this view that if you put your money in a bank, it would take that money and manage it conservatively because you wanted to be sure that when it came time you wanted your money back,
you would have it. What you wanted plus.
Exactly. And moreover, the government had, in the Great Depression, instituted deposit insurance. And that meant if there's a problem, the taxpayer would pick up the tab. Now, what we did in Glass-Steagall is we allowed those banks to merge with the investment banks. Now, the investment banks, their job was to take rich people's money and invest it. Well, the highest returns often are in high-risk-taking kinds of activity. High-risk-taking is perfectly okay for people who have a lot of money and they can lose something. But for most Americans, we can't lose. We don't want our banks to be engaged in gambling. And that's what they were doing. In effect, let me just give you one aspect of that. Leverage. Leverage means what you take your money and you invest it, and you borrow the rest. Okay, so it's all based on debt. You and the leverage was at a ratio of 30 or 40, and that meant that if the value of what they had put their money in went down just 3%, they would have wiped out their entire net worth. In other words, they still owed what they owed, but the value of their assets had gone down, and they now owed more than the value of the assets. They were basically bankrupt. Well, just to put it in perspective, the value of real estate went down by almost 30%. And they were putting a lot of their money in real estate. So no wonder our banking system had a problem.
Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His new book is titled Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. Short break. We'll be right back. If you've just joined us, Joseph Stiglitz is with me. He teaches at Columbia University. He's the author of many books, and he is winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. He has a new book out. It's titled Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. We'll get to the phones in just a moment. Here's an email from Don, who says, what if Republicans had remained in power? Republicans are widely deriding the stimulus as an Obama Democratic failure because unemployment remains high at 10%. What if McCain had won and Republicans retained control of Congress? What policies would they have pursued? And what would be the condition in the present economy if such policies had been pursued?
Good question. Probably what would have happened is they would have been a repeat of what President Bush did in February 2008. That is, a tax cut. We know what happened, what the effect of the tax cut of 2008 with the overhang of indebtedness of Americans, with the uncertainty in the job markets. People saved a large fraction of that, good for their balance sheet. But if you're going to stimulate the economy, you have to spend. The 2008 Bush tax cut did not work. So you ask the question, what would have happened if we had followed that advice in 2009? The answer is the unemployment rate today would not be 10%. It would be 11, 12, or more percent. It would not be almost one out of five Americans cannot get a full-time job. Americans who want a full-time job could not get it. It would be well more than one out of five Americans who want a full-time job could not get a full-time job.
Professor Stiglitz, you are saying in this book that you believe there's something systemic wrong with our economy. Are you suggesting that capitalism itself has gone awry, that capitalism itself needs to be fixed?
What I believe is that a market economy is at the center of every successful economy. What happened is that we lost the balance. And the result of this is that we don't have what might be called pure capitalism. I call it air socks capitalism. It's a system where we socialize losses and we privatize gains. And the result of that, of course, is that incentives are distorted. People behave in ways that are neither efficient nor fair. And so what I'm calling for is a return to a better balance, a balance between government and the market. It's going to require a larger role for government.
Larger regulation.
Larger regulation, but also better regulation. For instance, the Federal Reserve did not do what it was supposed to do. 1994, government gave the Federal Reserve the authority to regulate many aspects of the housing market. But it had this peculiar view that there could not exist bubbles, that even if there were bubbles, there was very little that it could do, and that it was easier to clean up the mess after a bubble broke, if a bubble existed.
Now, when you talk about the Fed at that time, you're talking about Alan Greenspan.
And in Bernanke. It continued.
And Bernanke. To what extent do you believe that those two men are central to what has happened to our economy today?
Oh, they're very central. There were other regulators who also failed, so they're not alone. And in the book, I try not to personalize this, because the point is, if they hadn't been there, somebody else would have been doing very similar. It was part of the zeitgeist of the time, this peculiar idea that markets are self-regulating. Now, we should have known that that was a strange idea. We had a Great Depression. There was only a 50-year period in the history of our country where we did not have financial crises. And that was the period after the Great Depression, where we learned the lesson, we adopted some good regulations. And this is true not only in the United States, but around the world. The short period before 1980 and after the Great Depression is the one period where around the world there are only a couple crises, financial crises.
But then you had the era of Ronald Reagan. You had the era of Margaret Thatcher. Ronald Reagan said that government is the problem. He said that again and again, trying to move government aside in terms of how it regulated, what it did, how it did it. And with that kind of mentality moving in to the zeitgeist, as you put it, was it inevitable that this was going to happen?
In some sense, yes. I mean, when we followed that line of reasoning, it was almost inevitable that the consequences are around the world. There have been more than 120 financial crises in the 30 years since that beginning of that deregulation. I was chief economist at the World Bank, and I went through, one of the worst, the global financial crisis of 1997-98. In some ways, what we're seeing today is similar to many of these other crises. The only difference is it's the American taxpayers that are picking up the pieces from the bank's failure rather than taxpayers in Indonesia or Korea. Interesting thing is that the developing countries had learned their lessons, and many of the central banks in the developing countries did a lot better job. India, Brazil, those countries understood why you need regulation, and they had a monetary policy and a regulatory policy that avoided the mistakes that we here in the United States made.
So as we sit here now, President Obama has, there has been one stimulus package. Do you believe there must be more to get the economy back on its feet?
Very much so. At the time, it was clear to me that that package was too small and not well enough designed. Still, about a third of it went into tax cuts, which were not going to have much of an effect. The states are suffering really very severely. They have a balanced budget framework. When the revenues go down, they have to cut back. And that is a negative stimulus to their economy. Interestingly, the same kind of thing happened back in the Great Depression. And one of the reasons the New Deal didn't stimulate the economy as much as a lot of people hoped was that while the federal government was expanding, the states were contracting. And as I say, the same thing is going on right now. You go to California, state employees are being furloughed 2 days a week. You know, this is a period where a lot of people want to go to college because they can't get a job. They're cutting back on the universities.
So if you were in charge right now, what would be the three steps that you would take to get this country back on a correct and growing path?
First, a new round of the stimulus. Secondly, we have to do something about the mortgages. We did a little bit, but it's not been very effective.
What would you do?
Well, the major problem right now is that one out of four mortgages are underwater. People owe more than the value of their house. When President Obama instituted a new program, he didn't do anything about these underwater mortgages.
So you believe the money should have gone there directly?
That's right.
To those people.
What I call trickle-up economics rather than trickle-down economics. The theory was throw enough money at the banks, they would start to lend, and we would all benefit. The fact is,
It didn't happen.
And not surprising, because they started paying out money in dividends and bonuses and didn't start lending.
And the third is
we need to re-regulate the banks. We needed a vision of what kind of a financial system we wanted. Parts of our financial system are doing a great job. Parts of our financial system are among the best in the world. Our venture capital firms provide funds to new enterprises like Google. We had small banks that were providing credit to small and medium-sized enterprises. That's the part of the financial system that we should have expanded.
And instead, what happened yesterday in Massachusetts indicates that the path that the Obama administration has taken has not been very popular, certainly with the people of Massachusetts, but perhaps an indication of people around the country. Did President Obama make a mistake by focusing, as he did, on health care reform?
Well, healthcare reform is a problem that we have to address at some time or another. The question is, when you're running a big country like this, you can focus on more than one problem. There are a lot of talented people, so that I don't think was the problem. There's a joke about one of our earlier presidents couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time. President Obama can do lots of things at one time. The real problem was not that. The real problem was that we didn't attack with enough force this economic downturn. They were, hoping that the green shoots last March were going to bring a quick recovery. The reason for that hope, in a sense, was that the financial markets did not want to believe that they had made such a grave error. But to me and to many other economists, it was very clear. The problem was that we had had a bubble. The bubble broke. They had made lending based on bubble prices. And there were going to be grave consequences to the breaking of the bubble. So there were two views of the world. One was the bubble was a dream, and we were now brought back to reality. The other view was the bubble was the reality, and we were going through a nightmare. And that if you could only, you know, talk up the economy, it would go back from that nightmare, wake up from the nightmare, and go back to that bubble world. But that, to me, was a fantasy.
And the green shoots, to me, that kind of creation of artificial rhetoric in order to stimulate the mind rather than stimulate the economy, did not make much sense.
I was actually very critical because I said, look, at you can't divorce your rhetoric from reality.
Exactly.
And in a few months' time, when the reality reintrudes itself, then there's going to be a backlash.
Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His new book is titled Free Fall, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have many, many callers. We'll open the phones now first to Brian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, Joseph. I look forward to getting your book. I got a question and a comment. When you talked about these high-paid bonus people, and I assume they have to pay these bonuses to retain these people, where would they go if they didn't get the bonus? Who's going to hire them? Who's left to hire them? And so I'm thinking, these people got no place to go. They may be highly skilled, but they really don't have another where are they going to go, to China? Secondly, if Mr. Stigler could comment on the years 2012, 2013, because I've heard that's like the eye of a hurricane with the world markets, where we'll kind of come out of this. And then yet we got Social Security looming in the future, needing more money. And the other comment was about China holding back on lending and how that might slow the economy or the recovery.
All right, sir. Many, many good questions, Professor Stiglitz.
Well, this discussion of retention bonus, I think, illuminates the fact that to some extent, all this vocabulary of incentive pay was a charade. It was a language to try to extract as much money from shareholders as they could get.
And these are the people who got us into this mess in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. So normal sense of accountability is that if you messed up on that scale, you ought to go. What did they do? They say they've messed up on that scale. They're the only people that can get us out of that mess. To me, again, we were using the word unconscionable before. I think this is another example of that.
Obscene was the other word that came in. Go ahead, sir.
The other point I want to make is that 2012 and 2013 economists are not very good at looking at crystal balls that far into the future. But one of the problems that we are going to be facing in the coming year is commercial real estate. A lot of discussion so far has been on residential real estate. But there are a lot of commercial real estate that was financed with five-year mortgages. And those mortgages are coming due in 2010, 11, 12, and 13. And there is a real worry that there's going to be a difficulty of refinancing these commercial real estate. Prices are down, rents are down, and many of my friends in commercial real estate say this is another shoe that's about to drop.
And what about his question on Social Security?
This is a real subject of concern to me because Social Security, the aging population, is one of several important challenges facing the country in the coming years. The challenges, the problems we faced before the crisis, but have continued to go on throughout the crisis. But the way we manage the crisis has led to a much larger debt than we otherwise would have had. The crisis itself has led to a higher indebtedness, but the way we gave the banks money without getting back what we should have gotten back in return has meant that the national debt is much larger than it otherwise would have been. That means we have less resources to deal with the problem of Social Security. And it's certainly understandable why there's some anger among, say, retirees who are asking, why should I be cutting Social Security when you gave the banks all this money that went into the bonuses that they're paid?
Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz, if he had the opportunity to talk to President Obama, he would talk about the stimulus, he would talk about mortgages, and he would talk about re-regulation of banks.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, Randall Keynes, wrote a book about how the death of Darwin's 10-year-old daughter influenced Darwin's ideas about evolution and his views on religion. That book has been adapted into the new film Creation. We'll talk with Randall Keynes on the next Fresh Air.
Just before the break, we were talking about a conversation that Joseph Stiglitz might have with President Obama. In fact, he has spoken directly with him. Joseph Stiglitz, what did you and the president speak about?
Well, this was a meeting several months ago in the midst of the bank turmoil. And the question was, what was the best way of dealing with that problem? My view was that we ought to use the ordinary rules of capitalism. In a capitalist economy, it's quite often the case that firms owe more money than they can pay. And when that happens, you go into bankruptcy. And when you go into bankruptcy, shareholders lose everything. Bondholders become the new shareholders. And that same basic principle applies to banks with one or two differences. One difference is that you don't want to wait until the bank is collapsed because you want to be able to get the money out. So you act preemptively before the whole thing falls apart. And the second thing is that the government has a bigger stake because it's insured depositors. So it has a greater involvement. The basic principle, though, is exactly the same. You have a bank that's in trouble. What you do is the shareholders lose everything. You convert the bondholders into the shareholders, and sometimes you need to use more government money. If you have enough government money, actually the bondholders lose everything, and the government owns the bank, and then you privatize it. You sell it off after you restructure it and get it going again. So it's just the ordinary laws of capitalism, but that's not what we did. What we did is not only did we bail out the banks and save the banks, we bailed out the bankers, the bondholders, and the shareholders.
What about Lehman Brothers? Should that have gone down?
The issue there was the way it was managed. What we basically did is they closed their eyes and prayed. You have to do these things in an orderly way. That's why we have bankruptcy laws, to try to do. We have a special set of laws for banks so that it can be done in an orderly way. I described before the difference between an ordinary bankruptcy and what we do for the banks, precisely because we want this to be done smoothly. But what they did is they just basically closed their eyes. Now, what they said it was, they didn't have the regulatory authority. Yet, a couple days later, they bailed out AIG. Where did the regulatory authority come? But even more to the point, they knew that there were problems with Lehman Brothers. Everybody in New York knew that after Bear Stearns fell, Lehman Brothers was next. That was the popular conversation. Given that, if they didn't have the regulatory authority, they should have gone to Congress right away and said, we have a problem here.
What was the president's reaction to your comments?
Well, fortunately at the time, or unfortunately, things had already been done. And the question was, going forward, would there be another round of failures? So far, the fortunate position is that we haven't had that kind of second round of major problems. We've had 140 smaller banks fail this year.
But did you also speak to him about your doubts regarding the size of the stimulus?
Yeah, there was the fact that I felt that there was a need for a second round of stimulus, that the first round wasn't adequate.
Do you believe he may move forward?
Yes, I do. I mean, the question is, clearly, the president also focuses on the politics, and he has to make a judgment about whether he can get it through. And one of the points I try to emphasize in my book, The Free Fall, there was the strategy that they adopted in the beginning of the administration of what I call muddling through was a highly risky strategy, for exactly the reason that it's turned out to be the case, namely that if it wasn't enough, it would be harder to go back, and people would make the wrong inference. Earlier, we were talking about how some people have concluded that the stimulus didn't work because the unemployment is still 10%. The problem was not that the stimulus didn't work. The stimulus did make things better than they otherwise would have been, but it just wasn't big enough to keep unemployment from growing to the level that it did.
And here's an example from Laurie, who says, I'm one of the 10%, the unemployed, though I'm fortunate enough to have a husband who makes enough money to float us for a while. As Mr. Stiglitz stated earlier, I'm frustrated with little prospects and feel my skills slipping away a little more each day. To help learn some new skills, I've started taking classes at a local community college and took the only job I could find working for minimum wage at a retail store. I've gone from making $50,000 a year to $8.50 an hour. It's demoralizing. And to think this unemployment rate won't drop for another 3 years makes me cry.
I think she said it beautifully in many ways, the kind of tragedy that so many American families
are feeling.
And, you know, as economists, we call statistics. We call it, you know, 10%, 19%, somebody says 8%. That story, I think, says it better than any of those statistics. I think it that is the real tragedy. Part of the problem is that we've talked about these separate problems, housing, the problem of unemployment. They start interacting.
Of course.
And one way that they're going to be interacting is that one of the distinctive features of the American economy was that we had a very dynamic labor force. People moved all over the place. But when they moved, they sell their home and buy a new home. But now they don't have any equity left in their home.
They're stuck.
They're stuck. And that's going to have real effects on the future efficiency of their economy and also the ability of Americans to cope with this problem of growing unemployment.
Here's another email. NPR reported this morning that China has declared itself to have emerged from its financial difficulties. They attribute this to their massive stimulus infusion. Please have Professor Stiglitz offer his perspective on this. Does he believe China has, in fact, gotten beyond its economic downturn? And if so, what is the implication for the U.S.?
Well, China has been the best student of market economics. In our macroeconomics course, we tell them when you have this kind of economic downturn, have a strong stimulus. And they did exactly what our textbooks told them
to
do.
But, of course, it's a communist society. They are free to do exactly as they decide to
Well, they have debates within their society. You know, it's not a country with one single person who determines it. They have a very lively debate on these issues and political compromises. So I wouldn't say it's quite that easy. It's easier than going through our. But they also had a clearer vision of the nature of the problem. They also had a stronger incentive, because they knew that if they allowed their unemployment rate to get anywhere near the rates that we are having, they could risk political turmoil.
And I gather they have managed to pull some 300 million people out of poverty.
More than that, actually.
Really?
More recent work from the World Bank suggests the number that have moved out of poverty are even larger than that. It's been an impressive economic feat. At the same time, they have not succeeded in doing something that they will have to do at some point, which is restructuring their economy from their heavy dependence on exports into a more balanced economy. They know that, but they've been talking about doing it for several years now, but it's been a very slow process. And unfortunately, in their stimulus package, they didn't do as much of restructuring as I would have liked.
All right, to Patrick in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. A lot of economists have talked about the macroeconomic policies and regulations that need to be carried out to alleviate some of our financial problems, but not a lot of them have talked about the people. And I'm wondering, I'm a part of a younger generation, and my generation has shown themselves to be more socially progressive with the way they've voted and with their polling stance on various social issues. And in addition, a lot of business schools across the country have started implementing ethics courses. And I'm wondering, to what extent will this new generation of business leaders and bankers take the place of regulation or supplement new regulation? Thank you.
I think social responsibility ethical views are very important, but they cannot replace regulation. One of the things that was perhaps most disappointing about the behavior of the financial sector is that not only did they mismanage risk, not only did they misallocate capital, but they engaged in predatory lending behavior, and behavior that I think is in many ways unconscionable. Not all of them, but some of them did. The exploitation of first-time home buyers to the extent that they are losing not only their home but their life savings, the practices that have come out, been revealed about the credit card, show that what you can describe only is a lapse in ethical standards. So I think it is important, and Columbia and other business schools, we're doing more of this, of teaching ethics. But unfortunately, you can't just rely on that. You're going to have regulations to stop predatory lending behavior. It's sort of like the bad guys drive out the good guys. If there are any bad guys around, they will look for those opportunities.
What do you make of the Supreme Court decision on campaign financing that just came down today, that there is no line between individual and corporate contributions?
I think the corporate contributions, lobbying, campaign contributions have been an important contributor to the problems that our country faces. It's very clear that the financial sector may not have managed its financial allocations well, their financial capital, but they managed their political capital very well. They bought deregulation. They bought a bailout that was very good for them, and so far they have been able to avoid re-regulation that would ensure that this doesn't happen again. The question is, if we have those kinds of decisions, we're going to have to find other ways to curb these kinds of campaign contributions. Full disclosure is obviously a move in the right direction, but not enough. One of the things I think we ought to be thinking about is making sure that people have access to the airwaves to make their political messages well known. So that would reduce the need for campaign contributions. Much of the money goes into radio and TV. And if we gave that for nothing under certain conditions, that would reduce the demand for campaign contributions and the influence that that has.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Finally, to Davidson, North Carolina. Good morning, Rodney. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you, Joseph. My question is, I own a custom home building company in Davidson. It's called John Marshall Custom Homes. And the question has to do with, when I go to banks and try to get lending for projects, what I'm always told, without exception by the banks, is that we would like to lend, but the government has imposed all of these new regulations, requirements, et cetera, that keep us from lending. So my question has to do with the contradictions between the administration saying we want the banks to lend more money, and my banks anyway saying we'd love to, but it's the government that is keeping us from doing that.
Rodney, is yours a big bank or a community bank?
You know, I deal with a community bank, but I also deal, and I don't want to name the banks on there, but I also deal with what I say, like a mid to large size bank, which is a recipient of TARP funds, and they have not paid the TARP funds back.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, this is an experience that we've had not this time, not only this time, but in previous instances. For instance, in the aftermath of the S&L crisis just 20 years ago, what the regulators did is to, again, overreact. And the result of that is they imposed very stringent supervision, having earlier done inadequate supervision. And the drying up of the flow of funds contributed to causing the recession that happened in 1991. So this is not the first time that this kind of pattern has occurred. The problem is that the banks have a proven record of reckless lending. So we don't want to have to bail them out again. But where we ought to be focusing our concern is on the speculative activities. If we curtail their speculative activities, the kind of trading that they've engaged in and focus their attention on lending, then the extent of the exposure to risk would be able to be directed towards the lending in the United States. One of the interesting things that's going on right now is that there's a lot of concern in China, India, Brazil, other countries, that all this money that's gone into American banks is finding its way into developing countries, in emerging markets. They don't want it because they're afraid it's going to start a bubble there.
Joseph Stiglitz, he's the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His new book is titled Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. Let's hope that we are indeed on the way back and that those in charge do listen to what you've said. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.